Okay, we're going to call the Senate Education Committee to order. Today's date is March 15th. The time is 8 o'clock. With this, thus far, we have Senator Huggins and Vice Chair Davis and myself, Co-Chair Meyer. So we have a quorum to conduct our business. I want to welcome everybody back. Hope you had a good weekend. We are going to continue our discussion of Senate Bill 224, an act establishing the Governor's Performance Scholarship Program. And as you recall, on Friday, we had an opportunity to present the CS that this committee had come up with. The Commissioner gave us his concerns. There was about six or seven main concerns that he had with our CS. And then also, if you recall, we compared our CS with the House version. And what we'd like to do now is spend a little time on the concerns that the Commissioner had with our CS. Kind of get a feel from where the and offer up some maybe compromises or solutions, and just get a feel for where the committee's at and where we'd like to go. The intent here would be if we could work through these differences and then come up with another CS, hopefully a final CS on Wednesday, and pass this committee on by the end of the pass this bill on out of committee by the end of this week. So in order to expedite the discussions, I'd like to have our two committee aides come forward, Mr. Stewart and Mr. Richmond, and if they could walk us through the points for consideration and maybe some offer up some suggestions. I know you guys have been working over the weekend on this. Co-Chairman Thomas and I also discussed this with them over the weekend, and I think we've got some potential compromises we'd like to bring forward. One of the areas I think of contention is just the non-traditional student. I don't know if Senator Stevens, is he going to be here today? Because I know that's an area of interest to him. Okay, with that, turn it over to our trustee committee aides here.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jomo Stewart. I am co-committee aide for the Senate Education
Committee. Before you get started, welcome Senator Olson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens, thank you for joining us. You're there.
Yep.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Again, good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Jomo Stewart. I am co-committee aide for the Senate Education Committee.
My name is Murray Richmond, and I'm also co-committee aide for the Senate Education Committee.
All right. Over the weekend, again, there have been numerous discussions, both with the members and from the administration, regarding some of the items of concern. And points of consideration that they thought that we as a committee should go through. As broad headings, and I went ahead and tried to synthesize them into a concise list of items for consideration. I guess I should stop umming. I took speech class. But I tried to break them down as much as possible into a concise list. The items of major concern regarded non-traditional student accommodation. Item number two was the career and technical track. Item number three, at the specific behest of the administration, was a possible cap on awards for less than full-time attendance. There was the usage of the ACT-SAT regarding awards. There was intent language. And then finally, there was the possible renaming of the scholarship program. And if it's all right with the committee, I'd like to go through them one by one.
Go ahead.
Okay. The first item of concern, again, was the non-traditional student accommodations, which broke down into three main points. There was the issue of the six-month proviso. There was the reinsertion of the six-year scholarship termination timeline and the reinsertion of the eight-semester maximum. Now, under each of these, I tried to give you differing options, a little bit of analysis and differing options for how you might accommodate them. The six-month proviso, again, the administration stated that their intent in putting in that six-month proviso was simply to ensure that students did not apply too early for the scholarship. An example being a 10th grader who would be 2 years from graduation already applying for the scholarship, conceivably not even having taken all the classes, all 4 years. you know, and being eligible, but they might still apply. They wanted to guard against that.
Sure.
Senator Stevens? Give us a real specific date on that. What are you talking about, 6 months before what?
Graduation.
6 months before their graduation from high school.
Graduation from high
school. Is the earliest they can apply, which would be, give me a date there. So they graduate like in June, so.
Say December, right at the tail end of their first half of the school year, they might apply.
Thank you.
Okay, continue.
Now, my read of that particular proviso, it essentially set up a one-year window, although the administration has just told me that no, in fact. It was simply meant to, again, safeguard against too early an application for certification, but that after graduation, a student would have as much time as they liked to apply. Noting that, of course, with the six-year termination date, the longer they waited to apply and certify their eligibility, the shorter their time frame for being able to complete a degree program would be. 6 years was the drop.
Senator
Stevens. Sure. Just a little concerned about the timeline there. If you apply it in December, you don't learn about it until, what, March? I mean, is that enough time? I mean, I'm just thinking about when it seemed like we were applying for my daughter. We started about a year in advance trying to figure out where she was going to go. So Jomo, could you walk me through that? You think that's December is okay to apply? How long does it take to get confirmation that you got the scholarship, and where does that put the student?
That would be a question for the administration, sir, because I don't know what the actual process of review will be or how long that timeline would be for review and certification.
It might be okay, but then again, it could be causing some problems for students, you know.
Sure.
Understood.
Okay. Let's hold on to that question.
Thank you. Very good. Again, as I state here in the analysis, of course, that window could be widened on either end or both at the committee's discretion. Or no limit, which I believe is essentially what we have in our current CS. Next was the six-year termination. Under the governor's original submission, you had 6 years essentially from your time of graduation to use up your scholarship. With a six-year drop dead. Under RCS, it's open-ended with no termination. But, of course, there are other ways to structure that where you could lengthen time, shorten it. And then, of course, there's the eight-semester maximum. Under the governor's original submission, the award would last for eight semesters. You essentially had an eight-semester maximum award duration. Also under that eighth semester, if you were to take, say, in a semester half-time courses, you would have essentially, you know, you would essentially have burned up one of your semesters, even though you only took a half award. Each time you take classes in a semester, at least half, or certainly at least half-time and receive an award, you burn up one of those semesters. Now, we knew that there was an interest on the committee of adding a bit more flexibility to accommodate non-traditional students, of which we have many. I tried to, if you look at the addendum, which would be on the next page, give a concise synopsis of how both the governor's submission, his amended submission, and of course our CS function in practice. Also, and I had sent this to one of my other staff, I looked down and I actually broke it down into what I considered four negotiable components. Regarding non-traditional students. The eligibility for application window, that's 6 months. The use duration, the 6 years. The semester count, which under the governor's submission was the eight semesters, and under the CS was 12. And then, of course, the semester count methodology regarding how you burn up those semesters. And I tried to do a bit of gaming on how you might mix and mingle those different components to reach achieve certain ends. In consultation with my other staff member and with the co-chair's proposed solution to accommodate both the desire for the administration to have some certainty regarding how long students would be in the system, but also to give that flexibility to non-traditional students, was to possibly have a 10-year duration window, keep the eight semester count, but change the semester count methodology so that half-time usage in a semester would actually only count as a half-time burn on your total semester count. Under that kind of scenario, a student could take half-time classes for 16 semesters, i.e. 8 years, achieve their degree, and still have 2 years on either end of flexibility time for circumstance.
And if I may add, they would only be getting half of their scholarship during those half-time semesters. They wouldn't be getting a full amount for going half-time.
Of course, because under other provisions of the bill, at no time is a student ever supposed to receive more than their actual need for tuition. So if you're a half-time student, of course, you would not receive a full award, your full $4,755, you would receive the half of the classes you're actually taking, the credit hours you're actually taking. So again, to review, a possible solution, those you see in the sample mixes, there are others, and this is the one that the co-chairs could agree to, of course, was a 10-year max duration, 8-semester count, but include a proviso that would allow a half-time, again, if you took a half-time semester, it would only count as a half-time burn against your total 8-semester count.
Okay. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. GEOMO, since, as I recall, at least the catalog that I entered college on was based on hours. And did you think about using hours? Because I mean, the college catalog probably still requires hours. And that would probably be even more definitive.
Yes, sir, I did. I did actually think about that. The administration has stated that their definition of half-time under the university, their definition of half-time is anywhere between 6 and 11 credits, which is essentially saying anything full-time is 12 credit hours. Anything less than full-time but at least 6 credit hours is considered half-time. And I did think about that, sir. Actually, just a total number of credit hours, again, taking full-time credits, it's at 12 hours times 8 semesters. You could do it that way as well. Again, instead of having a maximum semester count, having a full, looking at what you would actually need as far as credit hours for a degree program and allowing students to burn those up as they chose.
Senator Huggins' question. Are you confident that now this is just for college or vocational school in the state of Alaska? Are you confident that all institutions are on a semester basis and not on a term basis? I assume Alaska Pacific University. I don't know. They are on a semester, not a term. Seward Skill Center on a semester, not a term. Is that true? Because that really would complicate semester issues.
No, sir, I'm not confident. Again, that is probably another question we should ask the department.
Yep. Okay, well, we're going to bring up the commissioner and Ms. and Diane here in just a second. When you say term, you're talking about like some schools go on a quarter basis?
Right,
instead of,
right, yeah. Like 3/4 a year instead of in 2 semesters.
Yeah.
That may not be a problem, but.
Okay, we can ask about that. And then, again, as was mentioned, we kind of came up with 10 years as I think the commissioner mentioned to us on Friday that he had some concern with leaving it open-ended. But we had some concern that 6 years wasn't enough time. I mean, if right out of high school, for example, if he wanted to start a family, perhaps then you could stay home for 3 or 4 years until your child got to be to kindergarten age, or if you wanted 4 years in the military, then you'd still have the 6 years to finish your college. So that's where we came up with the 10 years.
Or if, say, you were, again, a working person, putting yourself through school, could only do half time, that would allow you adequate time to actually take half time semesters every semester towards a 4-year degree.
Okay, so I think what let's do, since we have basically, we're down to 6 points here, where we kind of have a major, or we have a difference of opinion with the administration. Before we go on to the second point, why don't we go ahead and try to get the administration's feeling for some of the questions that came up under point one, the non-traditional student. Commissioner, welcome. For the record.
Thank you, Chair Meyer. For the record, my name is Larry Ledoux. I'm the Commissioner of Education and Early Development. And for purposes of expediency, maybe Diane Behrens could come on up to the table.
Ms. Behrens. Sounds like there was at least two questions there for you, Commissioner, that Senator Stevens had.
Perhaps the questions could be rephrased so that I answer them.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, the first and easiest was, are we confident that every school that a student would choose in Alaska is on a semester basis?
Through the chair, for the record, this is Diane Behrens, Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. Senator Stevens, all of the institutions that meet the definition for college or university in this bill are on a semester system.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, the second question had to do with the application date of applying in December, and I just don't recall the specifics we went through as a family, but is that the right timing to apply in December, and how long does it take to know whether you've got the scholarship, and are students planning on a longer basis than that normally?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, ideally families would begin planning for financial aid much earlier than that. In terms of the actual application process, typically applications for scholarship and other financial aid occur in January and February of each year of the fall for the following fall. So the six-month window was mindful of the fact that the FAFSA is filed for the upcoming fall no sooner than January 1 of that year.
I see.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, it's also important to note that many of the requirements for the scholarship will not be completed until the end of the year. Wow. In terms of their credit requirements, they may not have their SAT, ACT scores. And just like graduation sometimes goes up until the last minute, qualification for the scholarship will also follow that line.
Yes, sir. One question from one of our earlier meetings that I never really heard an answer for was had to do with grades. In order to maintain the scholarship, you have to retain a certain grade. And I mentioned somebody I had knew that had gotten an A, and after that always took pass-fail classes. How does pass-fail fit into our grading system here to maintain the scholarship?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I would have to do some double-checking with the university, but typically there is a cap to the number of pass-fail courses that a student can take that will count towards their degree. So I would need to follow up and get back to you as to what the implications are of pass-fail.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions, Ms. Behrens or Commissioner, while we have here? I have a question. The 10 years max is certainly got to be more appealing to you than leaving it open as we had it initially. Any comments?
Well, Senator Meyer, I think that it is certainly closer to what we believe is the most financially sound system. It does increase the potential financial claim on a scholarship and makes the price tag a bit higher. Also, one of the purposes of the GPS is to encourage students to make good choices, both in high school and in college, because we know that when they pursue their degree with diligence, they have a greater successful outcome. And the more time we give them, the less accountability necessary to achieve the degree. We want our students to earn their degrees as soon as possible because it decreases their overall debt to their families and it increases their chance at graduation. So while it may provide increased flexibility for a student to make other choices, I believe one of the things that we're trying to teach young people, both in high school and actually in elementary school, is the importance of choices, that they need to make careful choices about what they're going to do with their life. And I think part of the purpose of the scholarship is to help young people think very early about the importance of what they choose to take in their life.
Okay. If I follow up on that too, Mr. Chairman, I assume you'd have the same concerns about the halftime issue we had talked about. Instead of eight semesters full time, it would be 16 at halftime. Yeah. So, could you respond to that, Commissioner?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, could you be real specific on that question? I'm sorry.
Well, your concern, I mean, I think we are, I'm looking at it from the student standpoint that I like the flexibility, and instead of saying you've got to get it all done in 6 years, you've got 10 years to do it. But I understand your concerns that the cost raises, and also the maybe the opportunity to sort of to not push right ahead and get a degree right after high school. And I was wondering if you're thinking the same thing about the issue of going halftime. What has been suggested by the co-chairs is that instead of 8 semesters at full time, I mean, that's still a possibility for a student, but should they be, say, married or have children or have a job and trying to do college, this option would allow them to have, instead of 8 semesters, it would allow them 16 semesters at halftime. But I assume your concerns would remain that we're not pushing the students to achieve, and we're also adding to the cost of the scholarship.
Senator Stevens, that's correct. If you use 10 years, and if the student was required to have continuous enrollment, which many merit programs require and we do not, that would evidence to me that the student is working diligently through their circumstances, whatever they be, to graduate. If it's sort of hit and miss, we'll take some classes here and then we won't, then I don't think we're going to achieve the objective, the goal, in 10 years or 15 years. So I think that, again, if it was 10 years and there was a continuous enrollment caveat to that, you might achieve the same goal. We don't want students to go 1 year, one semester, then not go for a year, and then come back, because we're not going to accomplish, again, the goals of the program.
If I could just comment, Diane Behrens for the record. One of the things that we discussed a lot in developing the initial proposal was how to make it successful. One of the things that I'm always mindful of is what sort of statistics are we going to be able to report relative to outcomes to a program, especially one as potentially expensive as this. I believe we would be putting the long-term sustainability of the program at risk if we build a program that won't produce the results you're expecting. And so that would be a concern that I would raise.
Senator
Stevens. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a big issue, and I think Senator Davis and I have talked a lot about the non-traditional student, and as a former professor, I know many of my students were non-traditional students, and I respect that they've decided to change their lives and come back and get their degree and all that. But I do understand that maybe this is not the place for that. Maybe there are other places to try to address the non-traditional student. And so, Mr. Chairman, I think I'm sort of changing my mind and really understand now, I understand what the administration is proposing. And maybe the place to address the non-traditional students is in the Alaska First program. Alaska Advantage program, yeah.
Okay. So if a student is part-time, you still want them to finish in 8 semesters. Is that what I'm understanding?
Senator Myers, that's correct.
Okay. And Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, DMVA has a tuition assistance program. And, I mean, I think it's more than just running parallel to the program we're talking about here, because it's an incentive for Guard members and whomever. But what will be the relationship between those two programs?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I can't answer that at this point. I would have to research that. I'm not familiar with the DMV assistance program.
Yeah, perhaps Ms. Behrens.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Huggins, I believe they would be complementary. However, as we've discussed, this would be a last dollar award. So to the extent that you may have individuals who receive the DMVA assistance have other non-loan financial aid and don't have remaining need, they may not qualify for all of their, they may not be eligible for all of their award under this. But to the extent that they had that amount of need, they would qualify for both forms of aid.
Right. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would recommend that we do get some input from DMVA on this, because I'm not saying it complicates their life, but it may complicate the recipient's life in the choice that they make between the two, and may take away some of the incentive that's intended with the tuition assistance. if I might further, Friday, when we were talking about this program, I mentioned once again the business of us creating a mechanism to address shortage disciplines. Because so far we've talked about making high schools better. We've talked about getting people into college, not having to do remedial training. But it appears to me if we really want to complete this, that the final piece of it, or potentially the final piece of it, is to have a mechanism whereby we create some new products to address shortage disciplines in the state that we have. And I mentioned math teachers at the time. But it could, I mean, you could be nurses. I mean, you name what it might be. But any additional thoughts on that?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I did do some research over the weekend, and I found a number of programs that were designed to encourage young people to enter the math and science areas of instruction. But I do believe that if this program is successful, we're going to send young people to college with the math and science skills to be teachers. I hope to increase the number of graduates in Alaska, and I think that as the students come prepared to enter science and math, it will also increase the number of teachers we have available and the number of nurses in Alaska, because they're going to have the skills to be successful. And I think what we're seeing right now is, as you know, many young people are coming to the university and they're not bringing the skills necessary for success. They're leaving. And we're losing great young people with great potential who can be our new doctors and nurses and math teachers and science teachers. So while this isn't specifically targeting, you know, those areas of shortage, I think it will have an effect in helping fill that need if it's successful, and I believe it will be.
Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I'm not sure that I come to the same conclusion, but it also takes away some of the incentives down the line. Let's just take the math teacher. Math teacher goes to UAA, gets a math degree, is certified to teach. Previously, if you went to the bush to teach, then you would get loan forgiveness after some period of time. Well, if you've already had your tuition paid and your cost and you don't have that loan, then that's no longer an incentive. So it's a two-edged sword. And I guess my recommendation is that if we're gonna produce smarter kids out of high school, we want them to go to college or some other training, then the final step, or towards the end of the step, is to look at things we want them to get a degree in so that they can be more productive for our state in shortage disciplines. And I would just ask us to continue to look at that, because I just don't see how we can be spending the people's money without solving some of our problems other than just, quote, going to school and getting a degree.
All right. Thank you, Senator Huggins. Any other comments on this particular item? If not, I think we have a pretty good feel on your position and certainly ours. And I think you've convinced the president over here that on the traditional, non-traditional student, that maybe there's a better way to deal with that. Senator Davis.
Mr. Chairman, I go along with what Senator Stephen had to say, that there must be another way to address some of that, but I'm still concerned about the half-time students having the same requirements to finish at the same time as the full-time student. I don't quite understand how you think that can happen, and especially when you think about the universities not always having the classes available that's needed for students to graduate on time. I can go along with 6 years versus four, because very few people are finishing school in 4 years now. It usually takes 6 years or longer, so that's the number that I can live with. But what about the half-time student? Why wouldn't we be able to increase the number of years that they could keep that scholarship rather than putting them in the same category with the sixth?
Through the chair, Senator Davis, I believe that, again, one of the intents of the program is to encourage young people, college students, to make choices and to complete their degrees as soon as possible. By extending it, I believe that they will not complete their degrees as soon as possible, and some research seems to indicate that the longer you take, the less chance you have to graduate from college, which is what we're trying to encourage. As I said, if a student was continuously enrolled and they had, you know, a one semester class or a half semester of attendance, it may not be as problematic because we have a young person who's working continuously and diligently to achieve their degree. But if they're just taking a half time here and a half time there, then we're not achieving what we want to achieve with this program, which is to graduate young people.
Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
And to the commission, I agree with what you just said. For those students that would be in school full time, and many of them would stay there, I mean half time continuously, if they had that scholarship to assist them. Many times the reason they have to drop out is because they have to drop out in order to make enough money to come back at another time. But if they had that scholarship, they could be continuous students. And why wouldn't they have the extended time? You make the point that you want people to come early and as soon as they can and graduate as soon as they can. I have no problem with that. You can have it all over that bill. But for those that does not meet that, they're struggling and need some assistance, this is a way to help them.
If I could, Diane Behrens for the record, through the chair, Senator Davis, the concern I would have is the question of the trade-off. I mean, if what we're looking at is a trade-off between a student having a total of 8 semesters over 6 years, or requiring that a student that is not a full-time student be continuously enrolled or risk losing their scholarship eligibility, I think you might do more unintended harm by changing the trigger, if you will, because it may not be possible for them to be continuously enrolled. But that's fairly high stakes if that's a requirement to continue to receive their scholarship.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead, Senator.
I agree with what you're saying, and I'm saying to the chair, I think that we should hear from students that are already enrolled in school and the people that have that concern talk to us before we make up our mind on exactly where we want to go on that. I feel that strongly about it. I can back off of a lot of things, but I want more input from people that's enrolled in the university or vocational school or wherever they are. And I know there's a group of students that's coming around constantly, they say they're going to be, to give testimony. That's something we could sort of ask some of them and have people phone in and give their opinion on it. We got time to do that before we make our final draft.
Okay, thank you, Senator Davis. Senator Stevens.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Behrens, maybe you could address this issue of, I'm not exactly clear how the whole process works. Now, the governor's bill has asked us to put $400 million into a pot, and I assume the interest off that then funds these scholarships. That doesn't necessarily mean that we fund every scholarship, every student that applies. There's got to be some criteria along not only grades, but would we at some point, would you as the agency that's determining who gets the scholarships be looking at whether a student is, I mean, you'd have to prioritize in some ways. That'd be true, wouldn't it?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, currently in the bill there is no method for prioritization. Without some method specified in the bill, I think it would be beyond the authority of the commission to create a separate criteria or priority. What the bill says is that in the event there is insufficient funds appropriated to fund all, essentially this is an entitlement to these folks, that it would be a pro rata distribution. So everybody would get the same proportion of their award amount rather than some folks getting all of theirs and others getting none.
I see. Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Well, thank you. I'm glad you clarified that.
Okay. Senator Rose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I just want to continue on with a point that Senator Huggins made. As we try and bring and grow our own and have them go to underserved areas, which specifically is the rural part of Alaska, they do have their scholarship paid for, what incentives are there out there that the administration is actively thinking through to try and entice people to go out to rural Alaska to fill the needs that are out there? Or maybe there aren't any. I don't know. I just was obviously very concerned about it after it was brought up by Senator Huggins.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, one of the greatest concerns we have in rural Alaska is teacher retention.
Sure.
And we are examining a number of possibilities and ways to keep and attract teachers to rural Alaska. Mm-hmm. We are actively looking at federal initiatives to see if we can come up with innovative practices. We're discussing with superintendents and teachers and communities ways that we can encourage teachers to stay there. We have some evidence to indicate that our mentor program is being very successful. Our new director of rural education is involved in active discussions with communities on strategies that we can use to keep teachers in rural Alaska. But I have to tell you, we have not come up with any solutions at this point in time. We are working on it. It's probably our number one challenge, is to make sure we have not just teachers out there, but outstanding teachers that stay. And we are approaching it from, as I said, from trying to promote early learning activities in the state to make sure kids come to school ready to read and ready to learn. So we're working through that system. We have a new career and technical education plan that we've been working on that's designed to support rural education. But that's a pretty broad question. But it is a critical need. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Davis?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to follow up on what the question that the senator just asked. One of the things and what this scholarship will help accomplish is the fact it's going to help us grow our own, have our own students go into our universities and stand in our state and working in their communities and villages. That's for cities, villages, wherever, where the need might be. All we have to do is prepare our students for what they want and need, and they can do what we want, because we have the problem with the retention. We have to bring in all these people from outside. They come in here, they want to do a good job. Some can stay longer than others. It's a sacrifice for them to do it. They learn from the people in the towns and villages where they work, but it's not enough to keep them there. But if they already live there, know the culture, want to be a part of it, and we see that happening in other programs, students are staying and going back to their own communities, and that's what this scholarship would help do. Even though we do have some shortages in math and science and some of the areas that we could fill that in, this would go a long ways to accomplish that.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Through the chair, Senator Davis, well said.
Okay. Senator Stuth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now I'm struggling with an entirely different issue. This thing is so completely bifurcated. We are dealing with a bill here, and I think we can come up with an excellent bill from Education Committee on a scholarship program. But then, once we finish it, we send it to those hard-hearted guys setting up at finance, and they decide how much money can be put into it. And now, so we're thinking $400 million. Well, maybe it'll be $400 million. Maybe it'll be $4 million, maybe it'll be $400,000. Who knows how much it's going to wind up being? So I guess my concern is now that Ms. Behrens has brought the issue up of pro rata share. If our goal is to get kids into college and out of college, they need to be fully funded. And if we can only fund them at half or a quarter or an eighth of what they need, that we're not going to be any more successful than we are now. So I guess my question goes right back to the very basics, Mr. Chairman. Should we be talking about pro rata, or should we just establish a criteria and say we will fully fund as many students as we can, and when we run out of money, we stop funding them, and that leads to success of fewer students, I know, but nickel-diming students to death so they really can't finish isn't an advantage either. So I know that's a new thought. We haven't talked about that. I don't know if you've considered it, Mr. Chairman, but somehow it seems to me we need to address, before we send it off to finance, if this pro rata is really the way we want to go. And maybe Ms. Behrens would have a comment on our commissioner on that. Is it better to have a program that funds, fully funds a few students, or to have a program that is sort of a niggardly distribution of money that doesn't really get anyone to graduation?
You bring up a good point, Senator Stevens, because I think even our scholars program doesn't, even though we say it's a full scholarship, it really doesn't pay the full tuition. So your comments, please.
I would share the concern that Senator Stevens has raised. One of the, and I believe that was one of the prime motivators against proposing the funding structure that the governor has proposed, is to define what the expected funding need of the program would be and to create a mechanism to ensure that there would always be an adequate amount of funds available. Now, having said that, of course, if the program was outrageously successful and we saw very high rates of graduation, very high rates of eligibility, the funding issue would have to be readdressed simply because we've made some assumptions. And so I do believe that there's probably a point of diminishing return if the pro rata amount that students get is so small that it neither rewards them nor incents them to do anything. Having said that, they will be better prepared for college when they get there.
Commissioner.
Well, if we don't give them any money, they certainly won't believe us anymore, right? We promise them something. I think that the way that many states control the flow of money is that they tighten up their criteria. I think I just read today before I came here during my morning reading that North Dakota or South Dakota just raised their ACT or SAT requirement to make it more difficult to achieve scholarships. And I think also they do it in Wyoming, for instance, by requiring continuous attendance. That means they have to start immediately after high school. They don't allow the flexibility that we have with 6 years. All of those, you know, add to the financial liability. We've constructed it to add as much flexibility as possible without trying to break the bank. But you know, the financial modeling is predictive. If we're successful, it will cost more, but we will achieve some of the outcomes that Senator Davis just shared in terms of preparing our job force and increasing the number of Alaskans who are taking our jobs, and including teachers. The needs-based component is a significant, you know, cost and drain to the scholarship program. And I think it's important to note that the legislature, the way it's designed, will have to allocate or approve the funds to the scholarship every year, and they can always approve more or less as they choose to within the scholarship. What I would not want to have happen is to make it elitist. So the very young people that we talked about last week, our D students who are now doing C and B work, and our C students who are now doing A work, those are the kids that I want to attract and get engaged in the system. And if we raise the requirement so we just hit this very, the aristocracy of grades, if you will, we're not going to achieve what we want to do. So I would advocate for, and that's why I'm being a little more restrictive, because some of the ideas that have been raised by the committee are good ideas, and they're good person-centric ideas, but they could break the program so that we can't achieve the goals that are necessary for the program to continue. So I'm being a little tough here in terms of how I respond to some of these ideas, because I'm always mindful of the cost of the program, because if it collapses immediately because of the weight of the draw, that won't be successful. And I believe the governor's plan was designed so that it would be self-sustaining.
Yeah, I think the commission brings up a good point that no matter how hard or how long we work on this, we're not going to come up with the perfect program. And I think that that we're going to be tweaking this probably every 2 or 3 years as we see how successful or not successful. If we're missing some students who you know, opted to have a family first and don't qualify, and so I can see us revisiting this program periodically.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Davis, yes.
Just going back to the amount of money that a student might be able to get, if it's going to be based upon how much money is in the pot and how many students apply, and you could narrow it down to such a small amount that it might not be beneficial. I agree with that.
I think we need to look at that. But I'm not on finance, but there's a couple of people here, and I think it's three people on this committee that serve on finance. And I do believe once they get that bill up there, they need to be looking at some way, even if they have to have two pots of money or whatever. They could have a $400 million pot there. But for this first year, just I don't believe that we're going to get there. I think it's going to have to be funded for 1 year, and while we continue to work on what we want to do. And at that point, we could put the amount of money we want to put in there for need base, separate from the regular scholarship, so that you won't say that they either eroded the money and the other people didn't get their portion of it. It can be worked out, and I hope that they work on it that way, and maybe we ought to have some suggestions in our bill to address that. Because there's no need to having a need-based component in there if it's not working. It's not going to be beneficial. And some kind of way, I think the money need to be split, and it's worth discussing.
Okay. Very good. Okay. Why don't we, I see we have someone here from Ledge Legal. Are you able to stay for okay, good. Well, let's go on then to item two.
Before
yes,
go ahead.
Senator
item two,
sure.
The one thing that I don't see on here, and then maybe you addressed it somewhere, I was concerned about us including the students as graduating in the year 2010. And this item that I spoke to the staff about. I don't see anything on here saying that was discussed with anybody, and it's not a part of this list.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Davis. Yeah, Senator Davis, the items that were non-contentious, we didn't include them on here for discussion.
So you saying that's non-contentious?
As far as I'm concerned. But, Mr. Commissioner, do you have some thoughts on the effective date on when we start this program?
Well, the program is designed to begin with the class of 2011. To start awarding scholarships to the class of 2010 would be a direct appropriation, or you would have to wait a year until the if you used a $400 million set aside, and then you would have to pay them based on their freshman year of performance for access to the scholarship, or you could go back and reimburse those people who were successful. To be very frank, we haven't analyzed that thoroughly, but it's just an act of legislative will and money to make that happen. And I would also point out it would be very difficult for us to develop the regulations, you know, between now and the start of school. So it would have to be some program that started, you know, during the fall 2011, whether it was reimbursing them back for their first year or looking backwards so that we could use the money generated by the account. We haven't analyzed that. Could we do it if we were told to? Sure.
Could I just clarify, sure, though? Through the chair, Senator Davis, I was thinking that what you had described at a prior hearing was not necessarily fund them in fall of 2010,
correct,
but include them in the eligible pool,
yes,
of the first class that would receive the awards.
Correct.
Okay, so it wouldn't be a retroactive funding of the prior. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so would we have to make the... We would just have to make the effective date such that it would include this year's graduates. Is that how would we do this?
Senator Romero, that would be my understanding.
Okay. Okay. Great. Let's move on then to item two, and then I know we're going to lose some folks here in about 10 minutes, and then we do have Ledge Legal here to help us with item five. But I don't think we need the finance guys here when we take up the intent language. So, Jomo, if you could come back and walk us through item two. I do think the first two items are probably going to be our toughest ones as far as coming up with the solution or compromise. Mr. Stewart, item two.
Jomo Stewart, Co-Committee 8 of the Senate Education Committee. Item number two is actually involves two items related to the career and technical track students. Under the original governor's submission, there were dual tracks for scholarship, one for the quote-unquote academic, and then a second specifically designed to encourage to offer scholarships to career and technical track students. Associated with that career and technical track was, of course, a $3,000 per year cap on awards for career track students once they went to their career schools. Under the CS, there almost was a loss of distinction between those two different career tracks, essentially a unified scholarship. Language had been included in the CS that said that a student having achieved the quote-unquote high academic performance could use their scholarship wherever they wished. Again, a person who, an A student who had done rigorous work in a curriculum that was vigorously applied and having achieved an A could use their scholarship whether they wanted to be a rocket scientist and go to UA or if they wanted to be a heavy equipment operator going to Avtech. So essentially the administration has asked us to reinsert the original career track, the justification being that that reinsertion allows them to essentially make a differentiated curriculum. I believe that the description was is that a young person who wants to be a pipe fitter or again perhaps a heavy equipment operator may not necessarily need trigonometry, whereas you might want, again on the higher academic track, you might want to include within their 4 years of mathematics things like trigonometry and perhaps even basic calculus. So that was the justification.
Okay, any thoughts, questions? I guess the question I would have then again is the 3,000 would also be implemented on a prorated basis, assuming we run short of money, but that'll be a question for the commissioner.
And the administration will probably speak to this again, but the justification, of course, for the $3,000 cap, the largest justification was to guard against tuition inflation. A number of these career and technical classes are actually offered by the University of Alaska, which has a well-established tuition system, well-publicized. There are, however, on the quote-unquote lists of other eligible career and technical training centers, ones that might possibly be independent of the university, independent of the state itself. Avtech, of course, is a state entity. I believe that on one of the lists, I remember seeing a hairdressing school. Again, the state does have an interest. Being a hairdresser is gainful employment. It is an honorable profession. And in fact, you could possibly conceivably earn a living wage doing it. And the state has an interest in allowing people to follow those kind of career tracks. However, the state wouldn't want a hairdressing school that originally had cost $1,000 for a semester's worth of study to now suddenly balloon its tuition up to $3,000 simply to meet the gold standard.
Okay, very good. And then on the CS, just to refresh my memory, we had no limit on we didn't have a 3,000 cap. We made it the same as the other program.
It's the exact same amount. It's basically one scholarship that could be used at either a career school or an academic institution.
Okay. I think I understand the commissioner's concerns there is that some of the VOTEC schools are much less. And so if they know there's 5,000 or 6,000 available, they might be tempted to raise their tuition. Okay.
But always under the proviso that the state will never be paying more than the actual cost of tuition. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
One of the issues there was that a student who was getting a career track, they have no incentive to do A work at this point because they're not going to get that level of scholarship. If they knew they wanted to go to career school, they're only going to get 3,000. And so they could say, well, a C is good enough, C plus is good enough. And they would actually get more doing C plus work than they would get doing C plus work going to an academic institution.
Senator Davis.
Mr. Chairman, rather than the 3,000 is you're suggesting that we reinsert that
yes.
As a cap, couldn't get any more than that. Couldn't we have it up to a certain amount, but what the regular student would get by going to the university, if the class just happened to cost that much, why penalize a VOTEC student saying they can't get but 3,000?
That's a good question. I think we'll ask the commissioner on that, since that was his target number.
Okay.
Senator Stevens?
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up what Senator Davis said, you know, we keep hearing that that we're preparing kids for careers that don't even exist now. And so how do we know what VocTech program is going to be out there in some complex, you know, interweb type of thing? You know, it's pretty hard for us to decide here what the needs are going to be 10 or 20 years from now. So I'd hate to really make a $3,000 limit when, in fact, that simply might not be enough for a career tech program. Just a thought.
Okay. Those are both darn good thoughts. It's just that, again, I think the commissioner's a little concerned on the financial impact this is going to have if we don't put some caps on. But I'll let him speak. Okay, did you guys have anything else to add before we ask Ms. Behrens and the commissioner back up?
We could, but...
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I would like to see the, quote, list that Department of Labor is going to maintain. And it appears to me there's still, I think Ms. Behrens, I'd like to hear her address that. I think she has, quote, a list also, different responsibility, but somewhere those lists have to come together to be, quote, a master list, for lack of a better term. But next meeting, I'd like to see the list.
Okay. Now, you guys had a copy of, I think, the three different lists. And I think the bill says Department of Labor is going to have the list. Okay.
Yes, sir. Last week, I passed out all three of the lists that I could find, one that is maintained by the commission, one that is maintained by the Department of Labor, and then one more that is actually embedded in statute. Under either one of, under any of the constructs that as they have been presented, a master list would be created, although I do not believe at this point they have gone out and done so. One of the questions that had been on this list of possible items for consideration was whether or not the department and the commission would have to come back to the legislature with that list at some point for you all, at least to review it. But again, at this moment, they are supposed to create a list. So no unified list is at this moment in existence. To show you, sir.
Okay. Very good. Commissioner, if you want to join us, please. Parents, thank you again. Okay, I think you heard some of the concerns on the career and technical track and the concerns with putting a cap on the $3,000, but you could just give us your
well,
thoughts.
Thank you, Senator Myers. For the record, my name is Larry Ledone, the Commissioner of Education and Early Development. The list that we're talking about is going to be created by the Department of Labor and reviewed regularly. That means almost continuously. The lists that you've seen in statute are created for different purposes. This list is designed specifically for the scholarship program and, as I said, would be continuously adjusted, and it will be developed by the Department of Labor in consultation with the Department of Education and the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. We want to make sure that the programs that qualify are quality programs, and the Department of Labor and Workforce Development is the best agency to review that. And the list would change as programs came online and they applied for eligibility to the program. We certainly want as many programs that are quality in the state of Alaska, because then students don't have to leave the state for training. And so we think that's a good thing. Also, the legislation requires that we report annually to the legislature on the usage of the scholarship, where it's working, where it's not, statistical information. And that would provide an opportunity annually, if there was a problem, to adjust the amount of money available. And as Senator Meyer mentioned earlier today, these programs evolve in states. There is no perfect bill. When, because of the annual report and the amount of money that we're expending, there's a lot of interest in the program. And they do evolve. In every state, you see the programs growing and becoming more responsive. So we believe that the $3,000 is more than enough to cover the cost of most programs in the state. Students also can earn an academic scholarship and use that in a technical program. So the C-plus scholarship under the Career and Technical would allow them to have $3,000 a year, but if they worked harder and took the academic track, if you will, a more rigorous track, they could use the funds generated at that at a Career and Technical school. And again, 90% of the programs are taught by the University of Alaska. And so those students could use those monies for technical scholarships there. We believe also, just in response to the question earlier, that having a separate track for career and technical education ensures that that track is not lost. In almost every program, when people talk about, post-secondary, they're talking about college, when the vast majority of our students will go down a career track, at least research shows. So we want to make sure that that track is distinct and clear and not lost in the college pathway.
Okay, very good.
That's good like clarification. I still think that rather than thinking about what future things might come, we have to be right where we are, the here and the now, and making sure that the $3,000 is appropriate for the time being. So if that's appropriate, you're saying that almost meet almost all of them. You're going to bring me that information back saying what the present cost is, then we'll be able to judge if that is enough. $3,000 is enough. Almost enough might not be enough. I know you're worried about the cost, but that is not necessarily your responsibility to worry about. Finance takes care of that. Okay?
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, sir. Just carrying on with that, I mean, as I think of visiting the villages on Quiddick Island, the hero of many kids growing up in the villages are the pilots who come in. And I don't know if a $3,000 cap would cover the education that pilots need. I mean, if you're going to fly a 747, you certainly need, I don't know if that's enough. So could you address that specifically, Diane, maybe, or Larry? There must be technical programs that are more expensive than welding schools or plumbing schools.
This is Diane Behrens for the record. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, there certainly are. Flight training is probably the most expensive. What we've found in recent years is if a student, specific to flight training, of course, the military is usually the conduit for someone who wants to fly commercially. But there are also collegiate programs that lead to pilot's license and certification. I believe the University of Alaska actually offers such a program. So I think that would be covered. But there are other, I guess the way we were envisioning the career technical scholarship working, particularly after the needs-based component was in, is if there are programs that are more expensive than a shorter course, it would be covered in that unmet need. It would be a shared expense because it's only 50% of that's covered, but it would trickle down through the formula, and on a needs basis, those who were from lower incomes would receive that benefit.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Could you tell me where in the bill the commissioner stated that if you had the grade point average, you could qualify for the regular scholarship and use that towards VOC training? Where does it say that in the bill?
Through the chair, Senator Davis, that's in the House version. That was a revision that was made in the other body, not in the Senate version currently.
I want us to make note of that because that's a good point. If a student know that they could qualify for that, it might make them work harder to get the academic scholarship. If it's in the bill, I can live with that. I want to see that in this bill.
All right, I think my staff is making notes of that. Okay. let's take a look at how that's written in the House version then and see if we can incorporate. Okay, very good. Senator Stevens, anything else?
No. I think it's been an interesting discussion.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Commissioner. I do want to go on just to item five here, briefly talk about intent language, because I think we can knock this out fairly quick with just a question. So if Jomo, you and Murray want to come back. We're going to go to item five, and I think that one question we had there with the intent language was, instead of putting the goals that the commissioner has suggested in the bill, that maybe that would be better off in a letter of intent, because there's some concern about putting goals in statute, but why don't you go ahead and elaborate your concerns, and then we'll ask Ledge Legal here to help us out.
Joe Stewart, co-committee of the Senate Education Committee. In the governor's original submission, there was a list of essentially programmatic goals that were built into the statute. Under the CS, we were going to remove them and send them along as an accompanying letter of intent. It was my understanding that it's customary within the legislature to have those kind of programmatic goals separate in a separate letter of intent, and that such language therefore would not have the force of law, but would still act as a guiding mechanism for the administration for the purposes of programmatic implementation, and also be available to the courts as a reference regarding the interpretations of statute. However, it would seem to staff that the inclusion of the purpose language would in fact give it the force of law, and that would essentially make it binding upon the administration regarding the matter of programmatic implementation, but also make it actionable in court. So we do have Ledge Legal here to give us an assessment on why in fact it may be customary to have this language outside of the legislation itself, or whether or not it would have the force of law upon its inclusion in statute.
Okay, very good. Let's go ahead and see. Is it Ms. Michelle?
Do you have a copy of that letter of intent? Apparently, I don't have it in my package. I must have left it.
Actually, Ma'am Davis, if you go to bullet number five, the intent language.
Is there?
Yes, ma'am. I've gone ahead and bulleted it. And I also, yes, ma'am, that's
okay.
The intent language. Right. And I also reorganized them at the behest of Senator Stevens with the post-secondary education stuff farther towards the top regarding graduation from college, degree acquisition, all that good stuff.
All right, thank you very much.
I'm sorry, and tell me where that was. I have the old one I was looking at, and where do I find this now?
This is it right here, Joe. It's in our packet.
Okay.
Item number five. Kind of in the back here.
Okay, thank you.
Great, keep going. There you go. Okay, for the record, please, if you could.
Yes, Senator Meyer, members of the committee. My name is Jean Michelle. I'm with the Legal Services of the Legislative Affairs Agency. And just to further clarify what Jomo's already said, the drafting rules that were adopted by your legislative council discourages the use of intent language in bills, and the purpose of that discouragement is to force the legislature to include substantive provisions in laws that are clear and not subject to interpretation or any ambiguity. And what this version S does is insert a purpose statement up at the top of that section that the Governor's Performance Scholarship Program is established for the purpose of ensuring that a rigorous curriculum is available in all high schools in the state and to provide scholarships for students. I'm not sure what the benefit of the administrative goals would be if those goals aren't actually accomplished through the legislative substance of the bill. But in particular, once a CS is adopted, we've got the addition of grade point standards that were previously left to the Department of Education to interpret. And the other than certification of the post-secondary institutions and the setting of the test scores, this language, in my opinion, doesn't provide a whole lot of guidance. The use of a letter of intent by the committee would, if adopted by the entire state legislature, both on the Senate floor and on the House floor, would be, from a judicial standpoint, reviewed if, in fact, there were an ambiguity in the substance of the bill or subsequent regulations. At the same time, leaving in policy goals may provide added incentive to litigate the applicability or the interpretation of a provision. So that's really the basis of that. And if you do go with the letter of intent, I would strongly encourage that it be included in the committee report and be offered on the floor with along with the bill.
Okay, very good. So I think you bring up a good point there, that if the goals are in statute and we don't meet a goal for whatever reason, then it's the potential for litigation. Mm-hmm. And if you do approve and pass a letter of intent, is that noted in the book then, in the statute books, that there is a letter of intent?
Senator Meyer, I don't recall. I don't believe so, but it would be clear from the journal.
Okay.
On the bill.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. And do you recall, I don't know if you worked on the House version, did they incorporate the goals in the bill itself?
Okay. Yes, they did.
Okay. Any questions for our Ledge Legal? Yes, Michelle?
So, Mr. Chairman, so as I understand what you're saying, then, is that you would discourage a letter of intent and believe that the idea should find themselves in the bill itself.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I'm not encouraging or discouraging the use of the letter of intent. If the committee believes that it is helpful in any way, and might provide guidance to the department, might be a good idea, but it doesn't have the force of law that the statutory provision might have in setting up any challenge to the bill. The main point of the main point of discouraging kind of generic policy statements and interpretive provisions in the substance of the bill is that should be clear from the actual mandates that are contained in the bill rather than a lead-in statement. On the other hand, there are plenty of programs in which intent language is included both in the statute and then other examples where that is included in letters of intent that's adopted with the bill. It takes a little longer for a court to find a letter of intent, and there would have to be a real reason to do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for joining us today.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Davis.
Maybe we could ask the commissioner to come back up and ask him what he feels about. I know he likes the goals, he wants them in there. Mm-hmm. That's what they originally had. It's my understanding it's on the House side, but could you answer a question for me?
Commissioner.
Couldn't those goals be accomplished through in your regulation as you do your regulations?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I believe so.
And I'm not Thomas.
Excuse me. Through the chair, Senator Davis.
Not a problem.
She has two votes, though.
Not a problem.
Chair Meyer, I believe that the committee has to make a decision based on the best legal advice that they have, and that would be my position on that. You know my position. I don't want the integrity of the program to be lost because I think it will change the lives of kids and achieve the goals. And so that was my position for wanting them within the law. It clarifies the law, but I am not a lawyer at the same time.
But what did you say about including those as examples in the regulations?
Through the chair, Senator Davis, I believe, and I have to be careful here again, because the regulations that we promulgate through the State Board of Education have to be specifically related to a law, and we don't have the ability just to create them. So I would have to seek, you know, the advice of our Assistant Attorney General that advises us on this to make sure that that is the case.
I'd like for you to do that.
I will do so.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I think this is an area of concern. I mean, a lot of your goals here, I mean, we're in agreement, certainly increasing job opportunities in the state, but then for whatever reason, if we're in a recession or what have you, and we're not able to create job opportunities, then does that make us vulnerable if we have it in statutes? Okay, very good. Thank you, Commissioner. Okay, so what's the will of the committee? Do you want to continue on, or you want to?
I don't know if you have other appointments, or if you can stay for another.
I actually have a bill up in finance. I would like to leave as soon as I can.
Well, that is a very rare occasion, so you should definitely take advantage of that and be there. Okay. Well, again, as I mentioned earlier on, the goal here is to try to get through these points of difference and try to have a CS that we can be comfortable with and pass by Friday, because we do need to get this up to finance. And I understand that the House version is already in their finance committee over there.
Okay.
So there's still a couple more issues. I don't think they're going to be quite as long as the first two, the cap on awards and the ACT, SAT, the renaming of the scholarship. There's a suggested name there that we can, I don't know, I suppose we could spend all year on trying to come up with a creative name. I'm not sure if we want to do that. So we'll continue down this list then on Wednesday. And we'll try to get some clarification on some of the questions that came up today. If we can get some students to give us some input on the part-time concerns, as you mentioned, Senator Davis, we will do that. Although we may just have to rely on students either emailing us or.
Oh, that's fine. That's what I mean. Any way we can get it.
Okay. I don't know if we can get any, you know, to testify or actually.
It just might happen to be some in town, but if not, email is fine.
Okay. Okay. Well, very good. Then with that, we will stand adjourned until next Wednesday at 8 o'clock.
Okay.
Did you have anything
else? I'm fine. That's okay. Fine. I'll ask after you join.
We're adjourned.